From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a former child soldier tells his story. Ishmael Bayo was recruited to fight in Sierra Leone's civil war after his family was killed and his village destroyed. He was given an AK-47, got pumped up on drugs, and killing became a daily activity. When he was 15, UNICEF workers took him to a rehabilitation center. He was later adopted by an American and graduated from high school and college. He's spoken before the UN and to many other groups about children affected by war, and he's written a new memoir called A Long Way Gone. After reinterpreting works by Mahler, Schumann, Wagner, and Beethoven, jazz composer Uri Kahn has taken on Mozart. Kevin Whitehead has a review of his new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When my guest Ishmael Bayo was 12, killing became a daily activity. He was recruited into the army as a child soldier in Sierra Leone's Civil War in 1993. His family had been killed and his village destroyed, so his squad became his family. He followed orders and was sent into villages to kill rebels and civilians. His life changed at the age of 15 when he was taken by UNICEF workers to a rehabilitation camp run by an NGO called Children Associated with War. He was later adopted by an American and moved to the U.S. in 1998. After finishing high school at the UN International School in New York, he attended Oberlin College and graduated in 2004. He's now a member of the Human Rights Watch Children's Rights Division Advisory Committee and has spoken before the UN about child soldiers. He's written a new book called A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. Ishmael Bayo, welcome to Fresh Air. You were performing with your hip-hop group when the Civil War in Sierra Leone started. You were separated from your family. You ran away, saw the remains of massacres. How did you actually become a boy soldier?
During the war, I had been running away for months and months with the hope of finding my family. I was running with my elder brother and a few other friends who were in this rap group performing with me and others who were our secondary school friends. So we ran for months and months, surviving rebel attacks on villages, escaping almost when we were about to get killed, and until, you know, seeing the path littered with bodies mutilated in different positions, and until finally we found out that I lost my elder brother during this time while we were running. And then I ended up finding another group of boys. And it was dangerous to be in a group of young people because both sides, the army and the rebel, the RUF, Revolutionary United Front, was recruiting children. So everyone, when they saw a lot of young people together, were very terrified. So that was also another problem we had to face. But it was good being together. And finally, I came into a village where my family was supposed to be, but by the time I could get there, it was too late. They were killed and the houses were all burnt down and everything. And so I was very devastated because I went from knowing that I had a family and the next minute having no one.
How did you actually become a child soldier?
Well, after my family was killed, two brothers, mother and father, I ended up arriving at an army base in Yile, where I was basically finding shelter and safety, and that was there for a while, and then that stopped, and I was basically given a choiceless situation along with a good number of orphans who were at this base at that time. And so we were basically asked to either be a part of this war or leave, and leaving actually was as good as being dead because the rebels who were surrounding the village would kill you because they would consider you a sympathizer of the army. So we were pressed into this after that with no choice.
So once you were basically forced to be a soldier, how were you trained for it? How were you taught to shoot and do whatever else you were told to do?
Well, we were taught in a very brief period. The training was about a week. And basically, we were just taught how to do a few military techniques, like to crawl, and to, if the commander raised his hand this way, this is what you do, and that kind of stuff. And then the AK-47, which is a light weapon that is fairly easy to operate, we were taught how to use that, how to fire it, how to reload the magazine. And that was it. Everything else came, perfection came with actually being in the war and fighting in the war.
Now, in a regular army, soldiers are taught to attack and to kill other soldiers, and they're taught how not to kill civilians. Now, things often go wrong and civilians end up being killed, but it was part of your job in this army to kill civilians, too.
Well, it, part of our job basically was to go out and kill whoever the commander had said we will go out and kill. So there were no questions asked. We went to a civilian village, if the commander said the civilian village were sympathizers of the rebels, we went out and did that and killed them. Whoever, if we ran across somebody on the path that we didn't like or didn't trust, we killed them. So this was not a conventional military kind of thing. And, it was you went out and did whatever you were told. And at some point, it had become so much part of your reality, and you did not question anything. Even in the beginning, you did not, because if you question, you can get killed by questioning certain things. So if you're reluctant, you know.
Now, you're right that you were told by the soldiers who were training you to visualize the enemy, that these are the rebels who killed your parents, who killed your family. These are the people responsible for everything that has gone wrong with your life and with your country. Did you do that? Did you kind of visualize that each time you killed somebody, that this was the person who was responsible for killing your family?
Yes, I did at that time, and I believed it a lot, because and a lot of the kids who were with me believed it. So every time we would go into a rebel camp or whatever this commanders deem a rebel camp, when I would be looking at them, you know, the image of what had happened to my parents or how they could have been killed and things of that sort came into my head and made me very angry. And so, but every time, you know, we shot people or we killed people, it didn't make me feel better, you know. And after I got out of it, I thought about it, you know, I wasn't even sure the people who I was shooting at or who I was killing were those who had actually killed my parents. But at that time, you know, that explanation was very appealing to me at that time.
Now, you describe in your book how in your first battle you froze, you couldn't pull the trigger of your AK-47, but then you saw two of your friends killed. And what impact did that have on you?
The impact that that had on me, I still remember these things very vividly, is that, you know, it just pushed something in me. I can't really explain it very well, but it just pushed something in me that made me feel like if I didn't pull the trigger, that I was going to end up like them, and that, you know, I had to pull the trigger. And so I started pulling the trigger. Something inside me, you know, kind of moved, and it pushed me beyond this boy that I'd been, this human being that I had been. I think it, you know, that was the point where, you know, I kind of went beyond my own humanity. You know, I lost my humanity at that time. You know, I had been traumatized by running away from the war, seeing things, but I think this was the final point where I actually lost my own humanity.
You can say now, in retrospect, and having gone through rehab and, you know, having gone to college and having spoken to audiences around the world about the experiences of being a boy soldier, you can say now, this is the moment when I lost my humanity. But when you were actually experiencing that, did you think, well, now I've just crossed the threshold, I've lost my humanity? Did you have any awareness that you were, in some sense, losing your humanity?
I had the sense that I had at that time was that I felt like I was kind of falling into some sort of nightmare, you know, because, you know, when I was there, seeing so much blood and so much bullets, you know, raining into the forest and things like that, it felt that you know, this was it. This was the end of it. You know, like I could either pull the trigger or I could die. You know, that's how I felt. And I felt like it was the you know, my whole body was not comfortable with it. You know, my veins were tightened. My head had begun to hurt. I felt like my brain was on fire. You know, it didn't feel human to me. You know, my entire body felt I felt uncomfortable in my own body, in a way, you know.
Well, you were also addicted to drugs during this time, to what, cocaine and something called brown brown? Brown brown, would you describe what brown brown is?
Brown brown, basically, it's a mixture of cocaine mixed with gunpowder. So, the reason for this is that, you know, after you'd been taking cocaine, marijuana, and all the different drugs, your tolerance it's kind of heightened, and so brown it's something that can serve that to make sure that, you know, because the potency of this mixture is very very high. And so not only does it make you high, or it makes you numb to everything that you're doing, you know, killing somebody, shooting somebody, stabbing somebody with a bayonet becomes funny to some extent when you're on brown. You don't fear that you could get shot or you could get killed. Everything becomes so simple that you accept everything. And also it gives you a tremendous rush of energy that you can just go on for weeks without sleeping. So
you were what, like sniffing gunpowder?
Yes, you mixed it in the brown. You mixed the gunpowder in the cocaine, and then you sniff it.
Wow. Just like sniffing gunpowder, that's just trying to imagine what that would be like. It seems like that would be harsh,
It is very harsh. In the beginning, you get a lot of burning in your nose when you start doing it a lot. But as time goes on, it becomes part of what you do, and it doesn't burn so much anymore. But it does hurt in the beginning.
Was addiction a way of making sure that the boy soldiers stayed? Because where else were you going to get drugs? Where else were you going to get cocaine if you didn't stay with the Army?
Yes. Addiction was a way to make you stay, but it was also a way to make you not have time to think about it. The whole idea of recruiting children, what they did is that you were either out shooting people, fighting, or doing drugs, or watching war films, you know. So there was no time to think. If they allowed you time to think, I think you probably would have started to say, this is not good for me, I got to get out of here, things of that sort. So there was no time. So it was a way to numb you to what was going on, to not allow you to think, to allow you to completely just accept this. And another thing, that during the context of a war, when everything had collapsed, community, family structures, there's nothing, you know, becoming part of this group after you've been traumatized, you're on drugs, it becomes, in a very weird way, it becomes almost family after you've lost everything. It becomes something that you're attached to, that you belong to, something that you're a part of when there's nothing else to be a part of.
You say that you watched war films when you weren't fighting. Which were some of the war films that you watched, and what did you watch them on? Was they video or?
Yes, we watched them on video. They had, we either used a generator, or we had a car battery that you can put a wire on the negative and positive charge and put in the back of a television. It would spark it up. It works. And so we watch Rambo, Rambo films, Sylvester Stallone, Rambo First Blood, Rambo Second Blood, Rambo this, Rambo that. We watch Commando, which Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, with the big bazookas. These are also films that we used to watch before the war that people knew about. But during the context of the war, it took on a different meaning, that when we watched these films, we wanted to go out and do those things, crawl into a village and take out a bayonet and, slash somebody's throat, like we'll see in Rambo First Blood. So this was also another way. And actually, there were people who had different names. Somebody would be called Little Rambo, and people would have, there was Corporal Gaddafi, there was this, So everyone had his names also based on these movies we were watching, or based on, whatever somebody gave you a name, or the commander gave you a name, and people lived up to these names. And watching the films actually also gave a romantic idea of warfare,
I'm wondering if the kids on the other side watch the same films. If the kids who were recruited to fight with the rebel troops were watching the same films you were.
Yes, I think they were, because when we came to the rehabilitation center the first time we had a contact with the rebels, we learned, and later on, I learned that they were giving them the same rhetoric that they were giving us, which is that the army is corrupt and they have these bad squads around that are going around and killing people and doing things like that, which we were doing in the group that I was in. And so they will tell them the same rhetoric, that they're responsible for your position, so you have to kill all of them. And they will tell the same rhetoric, and they'll watch the same movies. So it was two groups using children basically against children, or using children to carry out atrocities. That's one of the really sad things about the Sierra Leonean Civil War, is that the young people were being used on both sides, and it's very sad.
My guest is Ishmael Bea. His new book is called A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ishmael Beya, and he was a child soldier. He was recruited to be a child soldier during the Civil War in Sierra Leone, and he's written a new memoir called A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. How long were you a soldier before you were taken by UNICEF to a rehabilitation center?
Well, I was recruited, I started fighting when I was 13, and then I was in it until I was over 15. So it was about over 2 years, so 2 years and 2.5 years. Then I was taken out after that when I was 15 and brought into Freetown, the capital, at a rehabilitation center.
Now, you know, since you were like 13 to 15 years old, that means like your body wasn't fully developed yet. You were smaller. You were not like a full-grown man yet. Your muscles weren't fully developed yet. Were you used to do things? Were you and the other, like, boy soldiers used to do things that full-grown men couldn't have done so well, to get into spots or do certain things that would have been harder for a fully grown man?
Yes. Well, I wasn't fully grown yet. I'm a naturally skinny person, even to this day. So I wasn't fully grown or muscular as some of the other boys who were slightly older. But I think one of the advantages that of being smaller in the context of that madness was that you can actually go into a village and spy on them without being noticed. You can sit in under a very tiny shrub and take out a whole village without being noticed. So actually being smaller was advantageous in some sense in terms of gaining popularity, because you're so small, you can, you know, maneuver yourself pretty quickly where people who are bigger cannot do that. So that was I think that's one of the reasons why they recruit children, because first they have nothing to lose, and second they are smaller and they can do things that are impossible for adults to do very easily and quickly.
When you were a child soldier, did you feel like anybody in a leadership position in the Army cared at all whether you lived or died?
Yes. I you know, when I was in the Army, I developed a relationship with the lieutenant who I was in the Army with, and he had a Shakespeare book in Macbeth, that and Julius Caesar, that he read a lot. So, and because when I was a child before the war, I loved Shakespeare and I loved literature. So I really felt at that time that this was my family, that they cared about me, and that and I cared about them, and I did everything in my power to make sure that I was with them, and then so that required me going out and doing whatever they wanted me to do. And at some point, actually, I became a leader of a squad that went out to site, you know, scouting different villages or different rebel camps that we would attack so that we can get ammunition and food that they had. So I did feel like there was some sort of caring in a very weird way. I mean, now thinking about it, I have different opinions about that. But at that time, I fully believed that.
What was the most difficult order for you to follow?
I would say there was never a difficult order. I think the first thing that was very difficult to do was to go into war the first day. The first day was the most difficult part. But after that, everything became very easy. Yeah, you know, like killing somebody became as easy as taking a glass of water and drinking it, you know. So the first day was the only time that was very difficult. And after actually the first fight, I had nightmares and I wasn't myself. But then after that, you know, killing, going on and shooting people became a reality that I embraced fully and enjoyed to a certain extent, actually, at that time.
What do you mean when you say enjoyed?
Well, for example, you know, like when we would go out into villages, we attacked and we killed everyone, and the corporal would, you know, we would have some prisoners, and the corporal would stab a prisoner in the neck and kill it, and some of us would participate in doing this kind of killing exhibitions. We would high-five each other. We would laugh because it was so... in a sense, it was nice. It was fun to do that to rebels, to like, or whoever we deemed a rebel, or whoever we deemed somebody who sided with the rebels. So it became sort of intriguing and joyful in a very weird way, you know, to watch the corporal or even me or my fellow young soldiers to kill somebody We will high-five each other when these things happened. We will cheer. We will raise our guns in the air and cheer and dance around and did these things, you know.
Ishmael Beya will be back in the second half of the show. His new memoir is called A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. This is a recording by the Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, with the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA Cref, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at tiaacref.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After taking on Mahler, Schumann, Wagner, and Beethoven, jazz musician and composer Uri Cain has reinterpreted works by Mozart. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews his new CD, and we continue our conversation with former child soldier Ishmael Beya. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Ishmael Beya, who's written a memoir about his experiences as a child soldier in Sierra Leone's Civil War. When he was 15, he was taken to a rehabilitation center and was later adopted by an American. He's written a memoir called A Long Way Gone. How did you end up getting taken by UNICEF to a rehabilitation center near Freetown?
Well, what happened is that basically one morning I had come because my squad had gotten quite big, so I'd come to another town where half of the squad was and where the lieutenant was based at that time to get more ammunition and go back to our own base. And so we spent the night there. And so the following morning, a truck came with... at that time, I didn't know what UNICEF was. I never heard of them. I grew up in a village. I didn't know anything about this kind of stuff. But I saw men wearing blue jeans, white shirt with somebody holding. I vividly remember the picture with the picture of a woman holding a baby up. And this thing says in blue, UNICEF on it. And so they went and spoke to the lieutenant. And then the lieutenant asked a private to have all the boys lined up. And so he basically walked down the line and selected a few of us to go. So in a sense, it was like a natural selection process and asked us to drop our guns and follow these people. They were going to give us a different life, give us education and things like that. I was very upset. Now I was very confused. I follow orders. And so I was used to following orders, so I went. But throughout the trip and going to the rehabilitation center the first few months, I was very upset why I had left this group that I felt so attached to, that I felt like it was mine. It was like my family. Why were they giving me up? So I didn't want to go on my own accord. It's different. Some children want to go on their own accord in different contexts of war. But for me, I developed such an attachment that I actually didn't want to go.
In your memoir, you write about how you really hated to be told by civilians at the rehabilitation center what to do. Had you lost your respect for civilians, including civilians who were doctors and nurses?
Yes. When you've been subjected to the life of being in the army or, you know, having a gun in your hand in the Syrian civil war, that gave you a sense of power, a sense of invisibility. And then all of a sudden you were somewhere where these civilians who, like a day or two ago, you could have decided whether they lived or die, and they're telling you what to do. It was very, very annoying at that time. And it really got to me so much. So being in a place, all of a sudden being put in a place where, you know, it didn't matter whether you were an adult or not. You know, we'd lost all of that. You know, that was very cultural to respect adults. As long as you were not in the army, you were not a civilian. We even didn't like the city soldiers because we didn't think they had any expertise in warfare. So it was something that we felt very strongly about, that been ingrained in us.
When you were brought into the army, when you were recruited into the army, you were told that every time you had to kill somebody, you should think of them as being your enemy, the person who killed your family and killed your friends. When you were in rehab, the line that you heard repeated over and over again was, it wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault that you were forced to kill so many people. Did that line have any meaning to you when you first started hearing it from the people at the rehab center?
When I first started hearing that line from people at the rehab center, actually, frankly, I hated it because I felt like I did not believe it at all. Because at that time, I was still on drugs. I was still, you know, traumatized to some extent. I loved what I did. You know, I didn't think there was anything wrong with it, and I think I should apologize for it or anything of that sort. At that time, I strongly believed that. So that line really got to me. It really made me very, very angry. But as time went on, you know, at the rehabilitation center, we would attack the staff. We would stab them on the foot. We would beat them. Some of them fainted and bleeded, and then they would go to hospital. They would come back the next day with a smile on their face. And so over time, as time went on, it was the way they said it. It was not just the words themselves, but it was the feeling behind it and the genuine feeling behind it and the way they looked at us, that regardless of what we had been through, what we had participated in, what we had done, they were still willing to look at us as children. That it was the feeling behind it, I think, that touched us, that made us start opening up to the individual staff members we had become close to.
So, you know, initially you didn't feel like you had anything to regret. You weren't guilty about having killed all the people. You thought you did a good job and you were kind of proud of it. Was there a turning point for you when you started to have a different opinion of what you had to do?
Yes, there were several turning points. One of them was that this nurse that I befriended slowly at the rehabilitation center. I could not believe that she was willing to look at me, you know, with eyes that said, "You're still a kid. You're still a child." You know, like something must have happened to you, but you're still a kid. So for me, that was the point that I started. Kind of getting in touch with things, and also by being at the rehabilitation center and, you know, having withdrawn from the drugs, and, you know, the trauma was kind of going down a little bit. So you started to really think about stuff, because during the war you didn't have time to think. And now that you had time to think, now that you were not taking drugs, now that none of that was happening, you started to remember these things. You started to remember things that you did. I vividly remember some of the things that I've participated in doing, some of the things that I had seen done that I laughed about when I would think about it, when I thought about it then, I would cringe. It would send shivers down my own spine. So then I began to realize that, you know, that those were the moments that kind of I began to change, you know.
Now, you mentioned you were still addicted to cocaine and brown, that mix of cocaine and gunpowder when you went to the rehab center. Did they help you withdraw from drugs?
Yes. One of the things they did, because the center, they didn't let us leave, and we had no access to any kind of drugs. We tried to do different things by breaking into the hospital and taking up tablets and, you know, grinding them, capsules, and mixing it up and taking it just so that we can get some effect, but that didn't work. So basically, they put us in a position where we could not continue taking anything. So, you know, for several months, you know, we'll vomit, we'll do different kinds of things. People would, you know, choke the person next to them. People will run around, people will punch walls and things like that. So it was like we basically had time to... They didn't give us anything per se in terms of something that helped you to kind of bring down your craving. They just, it was like a very harsh way. You just didn't have any more drugs to take. And because of that, the drugs started wearing off you. And so if you fainted or anything like that, or if you're being abusive to yourself, then they will kind of give you an injection that made you sleep for a long time and, you know, so that you won't hurt yourself and things like that. But other than that, they just left us to kind of...
You know, you write in your memoir that while you were a boy soldier, you didn't feel any pity for anybody who you had to kill, and you really couldn't allow yourself to, otherwise you wouldn't have been able to do it. So you basically had to shut off, you know, basically all your emotions, and the drugs, I'm sure, were effective in helping you to do that. So when you got off the drugs and when you were in rehab, what were the first emotions that started coming back to you?
Well, first of all, there were a few things. First of all, it was difficult for me to remember beyond the war, because it's very difficult to, you know, in order to get to the childhood memories, I had to go through the war memories. So I think one of the things that started happening is that I started sleeping, which I had actually forgotten how to do very well. So I started sleeping, and when that happened, I had dreams that went beyond the war. And so that's how I started getting in touch with my emotion. And also I started, when I developed this relationship to Esther, you know.
This is the nurse.
The nurse, mm-hmm. Esther the nurse. When I developed a relationship to her, I started looking forward to going to see her, which is something that I didn't have in the war. And also she allowed me to start thinking by giving me the Walkman with the music that I'd listened to before the war. Those are the emotions. It started taking me back to places that I knew as a child, landscapes that I knew. And, you know, but it was very difficult to remember these things, you know.
Was there a particular cassette or a particular song that meant a lot to you, that really helped you a lot during the rehab period?
Yes. Before the war, you know, I was a big fan of the reggae before rap music. So the song, you know, Three Little Birds by Bob Marley, you know, Don't Worry About a Thing, Every Little Thing's Gonna Be All Right, that really meant a lot to me. And that song, to this day, I listen to it, you know, every day, because it makes me hopeful a lot.
How long did you spend in the rehab center?
I was in the rehab center for 8 months. And because there were so many children in line, they will have you spend 8 months there, and then they will put you with a foster family. But the process, I think, continued after that.
You were repatriated and sent back to live with your uncle, who died not long after you went to live with him. What was it like for you at first to be back in the world, but not as a soldier?
It was very strange. I mean, you know, I think, you know, turning a child into a soldier is the easiest thing anyone can do. It's very easy to, once you become violent, but actually it is so difficult to regain your own humanity, to trust yourself, to have people trust in you. So for me, not having lived with a family, having, you know, being in a life of violence and just all of a sudden being around people who were happy, they would smile, they would do these things, was very strange for me, were things that were so difficult for me to accept, because I had come to believe that of that happiness was fragile, and I didn't want to be happy because I didn't want to swing back and forth between emotions of being happy and being sad. So it was very difficult to be part of a family and to be in the real world. And, you know, at that time, the war hadn't reached the capital city yet. So a lot of people didn't trust us at all. So that made it even difficult. They didn't believe that we could actually change from what we had been subjected to do or to be a part of. So I remember, like, one of the times when I started secondary school briefly at St. Edward Secondary School in Freetown, going to school the first day, like, looking forward to going to school, and everyone sitting away from my friend and I who had been in the rehabilitation center because they had heard we had been child soldiers. And sometimes you'll be talking to somebody, you put your hand in your pocket, and people run away because they think you're reaching for a knife to stab them or things like that. So it's very difficult. It is a process that continues. It's not an emergency thing, but it's one of the most difficult things, really, to feel like you're human again and people to accept that as well.
My guest is Ishmael Bea. His new book is called A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Ishmael Bea was recruited to fight in Sierra Leone's Civil War. He's written a book called A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. When you were 17, you were adopted by an American woman. How did you meet her? How did she adopt you?
Well, after I had finished rehabilitation and I went to live with my uncle, an opportunity came to come to the United Nations here in New York to speak about what was going on in Sierra Leone and how it was affecting children. And so my mother actually now was one of the facilitators for this program that I came in, this UN UNICEF-sponsored program that I came to. During the time of the conference, you know, we kind of knew each other a little bit. And then when I left, I went back to Sierra Leone after the conference. She gave me her number, and I kept in touch with her. And so when the war reached Freetown, she got me out. It took a very long time to get to the United States, finally in 1998. And I lived with her and continued school. And yes.
Yeah. One of the things I found really interesting about your memoir was how important rap music was to you before, during, and after your time as a child soldier in Sierra Leone. You were in a hip-hop group before you were a child soldier. And in the rehab center, the nurse that befriended you, who you really liked, knew that you liked hip-hop, and she got you rap cassettes and stuff. You write that when you went to New York, you expected it to be like in a lot of gangster rap. You thought that New York City was a place where people shot each other in the streets and got away with it. How did you first hear rap in Sierra Leone?
When I first heard rap, well, my father worked for this company in the TAD, you know, American and Australians who, came in to mine certain minerals in Sierra Leone. So they had an area where we would go, like a center where they had television and swimming pool and things like that. So we would go there and watch television. So I remember going with my brother. This was when I was 7, 8 years old. I remember going with my brother there and to swim, and while we were sitting, we saw this music television that came on, and it was, you know, a bunch of black guys, you know, speaking really fast in English. We didn't know what it was. They're speaking really fast in English into this beat, and we were quite taken by it. We were like, wow, you know, we were very surprised, you know, growing up knowing that English is not our first language, seeing black people who look like us who were speaking in English so fast, and they had mastered the language. So, and then in the bottom, you know, my brother wrote the name of it, and it was the Sugar Hill Gang, you know, the Rapper's Delight song. So he wrote it down, and then so we would come every other evening to this place to listen to this kind of music because we were so taken by it. And then later on, we started to actually listen to it and write the words down and memorize it and recite it and try to come up. It really gave me, for me, hip-hop you know, opened up a whole different world to me, but also it made me want to go look in the dictionary to find out what words they were saying, whether I knew them and things like that. So it was very exciting, actually, at that time.
Well, you know, Rapper's Delight is a party rap. It's all, you know, it's just really about bragging. Of the rap lyrics that you heard, you know, before you became a soldier, which were the ones that really meant the most to you in terms of, like, the language, in terms of what it was about?
Well, first of all, I really liked Rakim a lot at that time, you know, and mm-hmm. some of his lyrics really speak. There's one, you know, that's called I Know You Got Soul, you know, and he talks about, you know, being on the mic, but also, you know, the verbal conquest of the mic, you know, finding the right words. It's almost like you know, like when you rap, you're speaking directly to your soul, you know, and I Know You Got Soul and things like that. So that was one of my favorite ones. But then, you know, other songs came along as time went on, you know.
And you're still listening?
I still listen to hip hop, not so much the current hip hop, because it's not so they don't say anything. People rap about the wheels of their cars and things like that. I'm not interested in that kind of stuff. But I still listen to the old school rap that I used to know. And there's still a few MCs, you know, that are very good that I still listen to and follow that have been good since I was younger as well, you know.
You know, now that you've been through not only rehab, but you've been to college in the United States, you work with Human Rights Watch, with the Children's Rights Division Advisory Committee. You've spoken to UN groups. I'm sure that you have a much deeper understanding of the meaning of your experience than as a child soldier than you did as you were experiencing it. So, are there things you understand now about your experience and about what it means to be a child soldier that you couldn't have understood then?
Well, there's a whole range of things. First of all, you know, the reason why I decided to start speaking about it is because I realized that I wasn't in a position that I could do this, but also so that I wanted to put a human face to this. You know, one of the things that I've gotten to understand now is that at that time, I felt like this was okay, that this was something to belong to, that being at a military base, you know, you sought safety and being part of the group was something that was good to do. But now that I have stepped away from it and I've reflected on it, I realize that whether a child voluntarily enter a military group, whether they're pressed into it, whether even the children push them to it, which are different things that happen in different countries that this happened, these are the different scenarios, that it's bad either way. Because you're not psychologically matured to make that decision for yourself, and it's psychologically harmful afterwards, physically for some people as well, and that there is absolutely nothing romantic about warfare at all. Nothing. It only brings suffering and continuous suffering to whether you're the perpetrator and the victim or people who are in between, things like that, that there's nothing romantic about war. And that's what I've set out to do in my work.
Well, Ismail Beya, thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Ismail Beya's new memoir is called A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. Here's that Bob Marley recording he said means a lot to him. Coming up, jazz musician Uri Kane and his ensemble reinterpret Mozart. Kevin Whitehead has a review of their new CD. This is Fresh Air. A decade ago, jazz pianist Uri Caine began a series of radical retoolings of music by European composers, such as Mahler, Schumann, Wagner, and Beethoven. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead especially liked Caine's take on Bach's Goldberg Variations a few years ago. Now Kevin reviews the new CD, Uri Caine Ensemble Plays Mozart.
Uri Caine, in the role of a hapless pianist who kicks off his Mozart a bit too fast and leaves his left hand behind. But once that hand tastes freedom, it makes a run for it, like it harbored a boogie pianist trying to break out. That ability to work subtle and surprising variations on familiar material is a tribute to Uri Caine's pianistic chops, broad musical knowledge, and dry sense of humor. On Uri Caine Plays Mozart, he doesn't go digging for the forgotten Wolfie. Instead, he makes a beeline for some of the world's best-loved melodies and then stuffs them in his blender. He'll play the music almost straight, move his hands out of sync like the 19th century pianist who invented ragtime, jazz up the rhythms like some swinging 60s Frenchman, or throw in a little rock and noise. But Caine's no postmodern coroner slicing up the corpse of old European culture. Much as he tinkers with the rhythms, he's so attentive to the melodies, you know he prizes Mozart as living music. His treatments may be weird, but they're not ironic. Uri Caine's 8-piece band, including electric guitar and DJ Olive on turntables, meets the pianist on his own ground, tweaking but not tearing the material. Violinist Joyce Hammond does the heavy classical lifting. Jim Black does wonders finding a role for the very un-Mozart-y drum set. Shying away from the ride cymbals, he doesn't clash with the high overtones of violin or Chris Speed's clarinet. Trumpeter Ralph Alessi has the right combination of jazz feeling and classical chops to nail this stuff. Mozart's Turkish Rondo, stretched across a Turkish 5-beat rhythm, an odd meter recalling Dave Brubeck back when he cut his Blue Rondo a la Turk. True, that had a different Turkish beat, but those are the sorts of deep connections Caine makes. In the end, his reworkings confirm the power of Mozart's melodies, both irresistible and indestructible. Uri Kane Ensemble plays Mozart is a miracle of tone, somehow respectful and overly familiar at the same time. It makes me wish Kane would turn his attention next to Charles Ives, American composer with a taste for musical role play, humor, and exploiting familiar tunes. Then again, after this, maybe that had seemed too easy.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Uri Kane Ensemble Plays Mozart on the Winter and Winter label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Adopted Son, A Story of Washington, Lafayette, and the Friendship That Saved the Revolution by David A. Clary. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's new audio walking tours called Sound About Philly at soundaboutphilly.com. And from Bristol Bay Productions, presenting Amazing Grace, based on the true story and song behind the abolition of the British slave trade, opens February 23rd. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, growing up in Colonel Gaddafi's Libya in the late 70s, we talk with Hisham Martyr. His new semi-autobiographical novel was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. His father, an opponent of the Gaddafi regime, was arrested in 1990. Martyr has been unable to find out what happened to him. Join us for the next Fresh Air.